reach the back lap.
That's a really dumb voice.
I know, but I feel like so
it's way worse.
And then you hear it, and you're like, well, that's not how I sound at all.
Yeah, it's true. Like, who's that? That's fine.
Yeah, some totally.
Maybe yeah, that's why I use my, like, phone sex operator whenever I do anything. Hello.
No, you always start, hello.
Hello.
No.
Hello. Hello. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, take it from there.
Hello. And welcome to a podcast of one's own.
Have we been recording this whole time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh. I'll cut it out. Most of it's too long.
Yeah, sub-manager. Hello, welcome to a podcast of one's own. I'm here today with Kara.
Hello.
And Sky.
Hello.
My name's Kate.
The saddest hellos.
Hello. And today we're performing a tragic play. We're actually going to be talking about Twilight. The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2. Do we know the official name of it? I think it's
Breaking Dawn Part 2.
But is it like the Twilight Saga colon? Is that the official title? I don't know. I haven't seen it, hence my misinformation. They saw it together again, as they do all the time when they see things.
You were invited, but you had different plans. In fact, you were going to come, but then you bailed to go hang out with a different friend. So
which friend?
I don't know. You said it was a pal, and I didn't ask him.
Seems possible.
We think you're cheating on us.
No, I might be. I didn't see...
than two other pals.
Regardless, I didn't see Twilight on whatever friend date I bailed y'all for. But regardless, our living as a feminist question of the week, only tangentially related.
It's quite related.
The way in which it is related is there is a character... I was going to make Renesmee the character I was referring to in the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2, and I assume Part 1 as well. Again, don't know. Which is the child of Bella and Edward Swan. No, what's Bella? What's Edward's last name? Cullen.
Cullen.
Yeah, they're the Cullens. The Swan Cullens. Because obviously they wouldn't go by Swan.
They don't hyphenate?
No.
Swan Cullen?
She's Bella Cullen.
She changes it.
Bella Cullen. Sounds weird.
It's not great. Renesmee Cullen. Also
still
not great.
My name's Miss Swan.
It's not a good name. Anyway, she exists, and so we wanted to ask a question about parenthood, and most specifically, how we, as young people without children at all...
And I think two-thirds of us have no desire to have children.
That's correct.
Great.
One thing we do have desire for is to tell people
what
how
to
raise
do.
Their children.
Yeah.
So like, get ready, parents.
We like judging. So we wanted to ask, how can a feminist raise a child, or maybe how can someone raise a feminist child?
I think that we should, we can talk about that controversy that happened last year about that family that wanted to raise a genderless child, raise a genderless person, but not to put a gender onto them as they were still a child. If they chose their gender later, they were going to, accept it. But do we have any, I think that's amazing.
I do.
But on the other hand, like, are you making them right away not fit into society?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point. And the other thing that, actually, let me address that one first, because I have another thought I want to bring to this anyway. But, I think it was wonderful what those parents were doing. But what I found really interesting was the response to it more than anything else, because it's not, like, a huge deal, in my opinion. But, like, the way it was sensationalized in the media and the backlash that those parents got for making that choice is so disproportionate. And I've actually been grading exams where people have been responding about sort of similar issues recently. And one of the things that's come up a lot is that people have been speculating that it was that people feel very uncomfortable when they don't know the sex of a child because they do not know how to act around that child without that piece of information. Like, they do not know how to navigate that, and that's very, like, anxiety-provoking.
I would go even further, and it isn't just about children that you don't know the gender or sex of. It's everybody. There's such, like, a drive to know the certainty of something and, like, to make sure you're not being fooled or deceived and, like... make sure whatever you're referring to is authentic, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And
so
it's always unsettling because we have this like way of being that you always need to know everything and know how to address everything.
Well, yeah, and consider even just seeing people in a crowd who you can't tell their sex immediately. And then like it always comes up in competition, like, hey, what do you think, like, is that a dude there,
Yeah, totally.
I have a question. Do we know the name of genderless child?
I think it was Storm.
Good.
One interesting issue with, I think, trying to raise kids in a feminist way, I have a lot of feminist friends who were raised by very active feminist parents, and which seems great, but one of the interesting conflicts that have arisen in those relationships is that, you know, their kids are now living in 2012, which has a host of feminist issues very different from the kind of feminism and activism that their parents participated in around, like, the 70s. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that I've heard expressed by, I guess, some of the children of those parents that, like, that they both identify as feminists, but they are, at this point in their life, on very different kind of wavelengths in a way, because their parents really raised them as, like, second wave feminists. Mm-hmm. And they felt sort of like they went out and tried to navigate the world with the kind of feminist ideology that their parents sort of gave them, and, like, it fell flat. And I'm wondering, because of the way that feminism's constantly sort of changing and evolving, like, how a feminist parent could avoid that potential pitfall or that kind of disconnection with their child, or if that's even a problem.
I mean, I think that you can avoid it to the certain point of, like, trying to keep up to date, or at least instill some sort of, like, it's okay that things change and things are fluid and you're allowed to make your own opinions instead of making it so rigid. But I think that is a huge problem. It's a huge problem in, like, feminism in general, of being like, what is it? What are all these different waves? And how can you be a feminist in all of these different ways? So, you know, second wave feminism might not be our version of feminism. We might not even call it feminism. So how do you raise a child in feminism, even though it's different of what we need?
Yeah.
But I think we've had the conversation before of, like, what is feminism? And we all didn't get very far.
But especially, I just want to say, given feminism's whatever it is, its tendency to be self-critical and self-reflexive, like, even more than a lot of other sort of ideologies and movements, like, feminism has a real history and tendency of turning back on itself and saying, like, you know, disputing itself and saying, I disagree, and changing. And there's a lot of, I mean, I know that there's a lot of people who identify as feminists with totally different ideologies from me, to a point where, like, it's a disagreement, like, it's a dispute.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of people are finding themselves now where there's, like, one generation and they feel so different about the movement and where the movement should go. And it's, like, almost alienating.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the solution is to keep current and whatever, but
but it's not just keep current as in, like, keep up to date, because you want to have your own opinions no matter what's popular, but, like, just be able to instill a sense of, I don't know, fighting for what you think is right,
mm-hmm.
I guess, is, like, as far as we can go of, like, how to raise a child being a feminist.
There's
like, stand up for themselves and what their morals are.
But what if their morals are something that one disagrees with because of their own bent or whatever it is?
Well, I mean, who can say?
Yeah.
That's how it is. I mean, you can't raise a perfect copy of yourself, probably.
That's always
people,
like,
people don't stop trying, though.
I feel like that's always going to be a fundamental, not necessarily failure of parenthood, but the nature of parenthood is always that we don't exist in the same generation as our parents. We don't.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
essential to having a child. It's the next generation. Or two down the line, if you're a sexy old person. And, like, that's always going to mean that there's going to be ways you think that are going to be fundamentally different, even in ways you can't address or know consciously.
I mean, now, like, what's really important to us in our feminism isn't going to be very important to our kids. I mean, for those of us who do, our generation's kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can even tell us being 20-something-year-olds and, like, the 14-year-old feminists, like, out there speaking on the internet, it's super different. There's just super different ideals. So, I mean, I guess it's further than just, like, fighting for what you believe in, though I think that's super important.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really is just, like, raise your kid to be critical in not any sort of one way of being critical of gender norms.
Yeah.
Like,
And of everything.
Yeah, and of everything. And but I guess
I have a follow-up question, sorry.
Go
I
ahead.
Just want to say it out loud so I don't forget.
Great.
One of the secondary issues, I guess, or not secondary, but another issue around parenting a feminist child, and at least the way that I subscribe to feminism, which is very kind of post-structural and, like, thinking about, like, how, you know, because I'm kind of always fencing, right? We know this. I never take a stance on anything, and it's always about, like, how a lot of things can be true at once, and there's a lot of different sides to things, and things are complex and nuanced and whatever. It's very hard to raise, it's impossible to raise a child successfully within that ideology.
I don't think it's impossible.
Well,
I don't think you should go that
way.
Well,
I don't mean impossible, but, like, I guess what I mean is, when kids are young, anyways, and they're trying to learn about the world, things have to be very permanent for them and very concrete. They, people learn about the world that early on in their life in really concrete terms, and things don't start getting nuanced and complicated until, like, later in life. So when you're trying to instill, like, just rules in your kid and, like, ways of navigating in the world that is going to make sense to them, you have to kind of buck your own ideology.
I don't want to get too specific in, like, child psychology because I don't know anything about it. but I think that, you know, the kids learn the rules because you're teaching them the rules in this specific way. They learn in this way because you're teaching them in this way. If you were to tell a kid, I mean, this is hypothetical, but if you were to tell a kid that some other kid is neither a girl or a boy, they would probably be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
After, like, maybe a few more questions, like, they wouldn't think it's as big of a deal and try to understand and, like, overcomplicate it as much as an older person would.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the way that we perceive children to not be able to understand complex ideas,
but,
or we're making them more complex than they are.
We overcomplicate because we have other things to think about in
yeah.
the background.
And isn't it complicated that there are two genders of people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't that hard to understand?
And then they just can accept that, throw in a third one, they can be like, oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Which is an ambiguity.
It's true. It's true, but you can't raise your kid completely in that vacuum. I mean, you're going to read them children's stories that are going to be linear and, like, things that are going to fall under the kind of simplistic ideology, and you're going to clash with the way you're trying to teach them.
So, I mean, you have to teach them to be critical of these things, to say that they are in the world, but that does not make them real or right.
I agree with that. I think that always, I think also there's a method or a degree to which just living your life and being an example is always a huge motivator, a huge method of teaching. Like,
yeah, of course.
Personally, like, I grew up in a household where, like, my mom made the money and was the one who, like, wasn't home and was the one who was, like, more, like, I guess confident and in some ways and definitely more career oriented. And, like, for what it's worth, it did make me, it was never weird to me when women made money or when women were not maternal or when women did X or Y. And I don't know, like, the manner or the degree to which that's necessarily a feminist implication or a feminist thought, but
I think it is, definitely. I mean, not to say that, like, feminism is just, like, women working and men not working, but I think that, you know, the instilling of just different gender norms.
Right, and so for me that was normalized, but it wasn't taught.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't mean that you have to sit down and tell your kid of, like, this is how you should interact with the world.
Mm-hmm. It was that,
you know?
Like, that's
just be open.
How my parents did.
I guess that they're going to experience it in different ways, which I don't, when I have a kid, I don't think I'm going to be open at all. Like, I think I'm going to be very overbearing and be like, don't ever say that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But
so
maybe
it's
I'll
like
become.
We got a good handle on this.
I mean, I'll become more relaxed by the time I have a kid. Hopefully,
I'm just such. My family who's in town recently, like, we joke about it a lot, but my aunt, like, censored my cousin's, like, consumption habits so intensely that she would put, like, a pillow in front of her face during sex scenes that they watched together, like, up until she was 13. It was insane. And so, just in a general way, I find the idea of, like, regulating the information your child can consume must make that information.
Yeah, it must be of some sort of power to it.
Yeah.
Or some change it in some sort of way instead of trying to, like, organize the context.
Yes.
Not that I mean, like, every kid should be able to consume every single thing in the world, but, like,
They're
going to anyway. They're going to hear the word fuck, and you should not be like, oh, don't ever say that. You should be like, this is what this means.
Yeah.
And it's terrible, and, you know, whatever.
I agree, and I think that's the case not just for children, but, like, in terms of just regulating things, period. Like, Judith Butler has a lot of good writing on that in terms of porn and trying to ban pornography and anti-pornography movements being ineffective and actually perpetuating a lot of the ideology of porn in and of themselves.
I mean, that's a whole different debate.
But
because
I
think that there's quite a lot to be said for the pro not porn.
Sure, I guess all I'm saying is sort of, like, I'm saying that, like, I think kind of over-censoring and stuff like that certainly kind of gives a weight and can be very counterproductive.
Yeah.
And I definitely think it does create a power to the things you're not allowed to do.
But you know who seems to be a really good parent? Bella Swan.
I mean, for how long is her kid even
or
a kid?
Jacob, am I right?
Oh,
parent/partner of romantic.
I mean, that's the, yeah, we'll get into that. Hopefully we don't get into that right away. But
so, does Bella seem like a good parent? I
no.
don't really
know. Well,
no,
I mean,
no.
she's not even a parent for that
she's
long.
Like a bestie.
I don't know, like, how long... Renesmee gets up to 7, but she grows super fast.
Yeah, she's
and
like,
so it seems to happen within a few weeks that
yeah.
she becomes 7. And she also leaves her, you know, she's not, I don't know. Well, I don't know what is a good parent. I was going to say, like, she's not with her kid very often, but
mm-hmm.
she leaves her kid with people who know what to do, like
mm-hmm.
the Cullen family.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know.
I guess, how does
she... Renesmee's not really a character, so you can't really judge, like, she has no personality.
Yeah.
You can't judge, like, how she turned out, or, like, Bella obviously loves her, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's important.
There's that one still I saw of them kind of hugging.
Yeah, I mean,
so
she's like...
There's physical affection.
There's a lot of her saying, my daughter, which sounds very maternal.
Yeah.
My daughter.
I mean, not that being
or
maternal
like
is, like... But she's protective when Jacob... When she finds out that Jacob imprinted on her daughter, and she gets, you know, angry and fired up about that. You know, obviously comes down from that anger too fast, but, you know, has it right away, which
sure.
is good and protective, I suppose. If that's what being a good parent is being protective.
How does Bella change from... Is this the first movie where she's a vampire the whole time?
Yeah.
What do you think of Vampire Bella?
Not much different. I don't know.
She can run really fast.
Is she still,
her eyes are super bright.
Is she still clumsy, or is she now, like, full transition to no flaws?
No flaws.
You know, she's not great at being a vampire right away. They have that, like, teaching her how to be a human again scene,
yeah.
and she fails at it, so maybe that counts as clumsy. She runs too fast when she should have walked slower. You know, that's her big fault in the movie.
She's got more power than she knows.
Yeah,
so.
Of course she does.
I mean, what I didn't know going in to see the movie, because I hadn't read the books, is that she, and maybe this isn't even in the books, but her vampire power is being a shield, so
mm-hmm.
she can, like some electricity person, she's like vampire with the power of electricity.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
She can like put out a force field and shield herself and other people from it.
Mostly her daughter, mostly her husband.
Mostly Edward.
Yes.
Never her daughter, in fact.
She barely knows the kid. She's like 3 weeks old.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like, how can she care?
She's known Edward for like a
year. Even the pregnancy was super fast, so like she didn't have that 9 months to bond.
It's such a weird thing that the normal gestation period and like rearing of a child was too much time for the plot of the... there had to be a workaround for that.
Yeah, it is strange. I mean, I wonder why. Maybe just to get over, like, the grossness of pregnancy.
I just
like,
think lazy writing.
Well, I think lazy writing as well is, like, they don't want to keep a baby imprinted by Jacob.
Yeah.
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 And then have Jacob wait so long.
And then have it be a 7-year-old. That's fine.
Well,
better.
Yeah. I mean, that's really problematic. Anyway, but I mean, there's definitely very gendered things about her being a shield
yeah.
for people.
Yeah, like, at least she's not, like, a healer. I don't know, is this better or worse than being a healer?
It's
she's
pretty much
tank.
Exactly the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's not so much a tank, then.
No, because she fights every once in a while, but mostly she'll put her shield onto other people.
Kind of exactly a mage character.
Well, they fight, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spec for defense.
So,
really, all in all, the movie is really weird.
Yeah, so, like, you guys liked the previous film, if I recall.
Yes.
We thought it was amazing.
It was
and
quite
that, was that mostly because of the body horror?
I think
so.
It was almost entirely because of the body horror.
Spoilers
as well as, I think...
Twilight.
Yeah, of course. But also the last one, it had such a bizarre pace, but it was, like, it kind of, like, reveled in this weird feminine excess. Like, it was all about, like, getting married and weddings and honeymoons, but then, like, had a horrible, scary body horror underlying it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that was a very...
Felt very subversive.
It, yeah, and it was very visceral and, like, as much as, you know, the scores in both of the movies are totally terrible and take you out of it, like,
they're
nothing else
really
in the world.
Confusing. I've yeah. never felt so
confused.
And I think,
Sky.
I mean, I think that's
it's
part
like
of...
a weird instrumental thing.
Yeah, but it's
it
like, the
like
tone
a...
is so off for every scene.
Yeah, and it sounds like one of those old school, like, Handel pieces that just sort of repeats, like, a very simple bar of music over and over, but it's so off that it's like, it's strange. I've never experienced it like that.
Totally.
Before.
And,
like,
and
I've never experienced
it. It makes you so confused as how you should perceive a scene. And that's what I think part of why the movies are so weird. It's like they're unlike things, at least these previous two. They're unlike things that you've seen before. Like, because you don't know how to read a scene. You're like, is it funny? Is
right.
it scary? Am I supposed to be like, empathetic, like you don't know where you're positioned.
I have a proposition about this being a totally strange film, and it goes along with what I can read into the structure of the series as a whole is it's generally a romance, and it's weird for me that an entire movie happened after a wedding, because that tends to be the end of a romantic arc. That
yeah.
tends to be the unification and maybe the pregnancy. But you rarely see the kid, and you rarely see a lot after the initial culmination of the getting together, right?
Right.
And I think it's so interesting and can be read in a feminist way of, like, that it's seen as excess.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't, it goes beyond that normal story arc. It
yeah.
goes into the honeymoon, which is just, like, you know, a feminine,
mm-hmm.
Air quotes, realm of excess, and you know, the notion of excess is super important to film, which I can talk about briefly, which is like women are often seen as excessive because they're not adding towards whatever the linear plot is,
mm-hmm.
and therefore are seen as less important and a spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their bodies are not there for anything except for pleasure.
Yeah.
I guess that's a little basis into excess. I don't know if
but
you have
no,
anything more
good.
To say.
No, no.
The example I always remember is a scene in a movie called Glinda. Mm. But basically there's a dance sequence that's just looking at this woman's body, and the sequence fails to move forward the plot. And so it's
yeah.
the idea that on-screen females and like what a female is up to tends
mm-hmm.
to not move forward.
Yeah.
The story.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I mean, even in, you know, I don't know if this has more to do with agency, but when women are the protagonist, it's usually the world around them moving forward the plot and
mm-hmm.
not even them. But that's going more into agency than excess. But yes, it's about being too much,
yeah.
too big, too out of it, too unimportant.
And interrupting.
Interrupting and, yeah.
yeah. Does Bella move the plot forward? I feel like she causes a series of...
The thing is, she does in the... I'm going to just talk about the last two ones. The other ones, she doesn't.
No.
In the last two ones, she oddly does the last one because she wants to have sex and wants to get married and, like, kind of forces, in a weird way, Edward to do all of these things. And she wants to have a baby and, like, she forces everyone around her to, you know, what... let her have a baby, which is
even though
bizarre.
It's vampire illegal or something.
Yeah, or something. I don't know. So in that weird way of the last one, she, you know, she has a goal and she accomplishes it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the movies aren't super plot-driven, so it seemed
yeah.
as excess anyway, I think partly because it exists within, you know, a feminine realm.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the culture of Twilight and in the movies themselves.
Was this film less full of spectacle?
Less
well,
exciting
know, like,
spectacle.
Guess...
In this one, I think less feminine excess and more violence.
You know,
was it spectacle?
I'm not sure, though, like, I want to come back to her whether or not she's active in these last two films, because it's true that she has a goal and she accomplishes it. She has a goal, but she doesn't have motivation. Like,
you know,
she wants to
have
a baby.
Edward?
Like, she has these goals, but it's totally unclear where they are coming from and why she has
yeah,
them.
I'm not saying that she's a fully fleshed out character by any means, and she's definitely not feminist, but is she, like, moving forward a plot in the last one, this one, no. And in any of the other ones, no. So I don't know why we're talking about Breaking Dawn Part 1.
But
except for that we love it.
Yeah.
What about her agency relative to Edwards in this film?
Edward doesn't... Sorry.
It's hard to really think about who has agency, like...
Edward doesn't have agency in this film. Who? He doesn't do anything.
Yeah, but, like, does she really... She wakes up, she's a vampire. Okay, spoilers.
No, she doesn't have agency either.
Yeah, so who does? Like, who has agency in this
film?
Who
moves,
like,
forward?
I don't even think anybody really
is,
moves,
like,
forward
the
plot. The
plot is barely a plot.
Is it mostly strung together action scenes and then some looking at each other meaningfully?
It's, you know,
kind of, yeah.
She has... I guess the plot is she has a baby. This baby is growing up really fast.
Is that explained?
Yeah, because she's, you know, half human, half vampire.
Mm.
So she reaches the perfect age of 18 or whatever and then stays there forever.
Yeah, what's up with that?
it doesn't make sense.
Is that biologically dictated? Vampire biology.
You know, they wait till she is at her most beautiful and
then
just stop.
You just stop
it. It triggers.
I feel like I would always think that my next year is going to be better and then I would miss my peak and I'd start going downhill.
I don't think they choose themselves. I think
yeah.
it's an app.
Someone else would do it. What
if
we're
patriarchal force that decides.
Do you think we're past our vampire primes, guys?
No, I think I get better every year.
I think I get worse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's really upsetting. I think I get prettier and smarter every year.
Well, I think I get smarter, but I don't think I get prettier. But I don't think her mind stops, too. I think she continues to,
nope.
to think thoughts and learn things.
You're not I'm not exactly sure that that's how
state.
Vampires work.
You're not a vampire biologist.
Well...
So, did I cover that in
okay.
You know what would be so annoying? But I just want to say, you know what would be so annoying is if you, like, have this choice of, like, when you're going to stop your body, but you never know what you're going to look right like, right? So you're never sure, so you just keep going, but then you, like...
That joke I made.
More unattractive?
A couple minutes ago.
I know you made it, but I just want to say that I've been thinking about it. And one of the things I've been thinking about is, like, it would just be really annoying, I guess, and then...
You can't say
I bet there's strange...
Yeah, where are you going with this? Is it really going to get deeper?
I bet there would be trainers that would, like...
No, you can't
that
do
would,
it.
Like,
no, too big of a world. Too big. I think that I would just have a really
Why
good day.
Why would I scale back?
Yeah.
Just, like, one good day, even if I've had been shitty days before, I'd be like, I'm just gonna stay like this.
This is the
yeah.
day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it would have happened when I was, like, 14, early. You know what I mean? It would definitely be too
yeah,
early.
Yeah, like, people with trigger fingers that
yeah.
are like, oh, damn it, I don't want to look 15 forever. Because
yeah.
you think that you are, like, prettier, and you think you don't look 15 when you look 15,
yeah.
but you do.
No,
yeah,
son,
totally,
I do.
Exactly.
You've seen me at 15. Not, wouldn't have been
I
a good
I haven't
call.
Seen you at 15.
Wouldn't have been a good call.
Anyway,
that
so,
highlights.
In terms of who moves the story forward, what happens is she has a baby, that baby grows up really fast, and someone sees that baby, thinks it's a vampire child, so like a child that was turned into a vampire,
mm,
yeah.
and then warns the Volturi, is that what they're called? Volturi?
Volturi.
Volturi. And,
is it? I think.
And,
oh, Michael
and then
there.
They Michael Sheen comes and tries to kill the baby.
Can we
the
spoil
child.
The ending twist?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah,
really...
yeah, yeah.
No. Let me do it.
No, but I just want to talk about the who moves the story forward.
Yeah.
And I think part of what makes it so bizarre, the Twilight films, is, like, there's not much of a plot in the first place, and so its whole realm is in excess and spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I
think
that,
certainly.
So, you know, in terms of moving the story forward, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as much as that can be an amazing feminist idea, and, like, revel in spectacle and excess, it, of course, isn't here, but...
No, but it is confusing in the sense that, like, you know, there's a lot of shitty films out there. There's a lot of things that deal in spectacle, but nothing quite like Twilight in the sense that, like, to have no characters that push the story forward... It's strange and, like, even from a standpoint of writing, like, almost difficult
yeah.
to move a story without having a character push it forward. And, like, nobody is really agentic in this film, and I just don't know how they did it. But the film feels, implicitly, so strange. Part of it's the soundtrack, part of it's a bunch of other things. But I think some of it is that, like, these characters are all very strange, and it feels almost like they're all puppets, and, like, you don't know who, like, this puppet master
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good way of putting it, because you don't understand the characters, you don't understand any of their I mean, again, I haven't read the books, but you don't, from the movies, you don't understand any of their desires or characteristic traits, personality traits, anything about them, and so they just kind of move in this free-floating way, which you don't know it's what anything
it's
for.
It's eerie, actually. It's really eerie. And I think that it really does feel like there's, like, a presence in the film that's not visible.
Yeah.
Where you're like, who is shaping this story? And it's really unclear, and it almost feels like there's something else there that you can't see. I would say it's patriarchy.
That is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's
I'm
patriarchy.
Just kidding, but,
oh, funny joke.
she didn't really think so.
No, she didn't.
But I think that's a really, really good point, and I don't have anything to say other than you're super right.
That would be such an interesting method or device to use deliberately and critically.
And to subvert in some sort of way.
Yeah.
Or just, like, use, but use subversively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
phantom.
Interesting.
That's fascinating.
Menace.
I have...
Oh, wait.
Mine's not good. You go.
Okay, so I first would like to spoil the rest of the film
yes.
so that we can interrogate this wonderful ending that I honestly, I felt so many things.
You have to set
moment.
Up what I said beforehand,
okay,
though.
I will.
Okay.
I'll do a long setup. So many emotions came out in this moment. I couldn't believe it. What storytelling happened? Okay, so basically, yes, the Volturi are coming for the child. It's a really big deal. Everybody wants the child to be safe. Everybody's really scared. So they go around the world and find vampires from all over the world to bear witness to the fight with the Volturi in case there's an injustice, because then there might be a revolution and they'd, like, rise up and overthrow the Volturi. So the sort of the idea, if they did something. So they thought by having witnesses there, the Volturi would be much more likely to behave.
You know, I thought they were trying to get witnesses to see the child and make... And for everyone to know that she's actually a half-human, half-vampire, not a vampire child.
Well, they are trying to do that, but, like, so, sorry, let me backtrack. One of the goals is to tell the Volturi she's not actually a vampire child. It's all a misunderstanding.
It's like... it's so
stupid! The whole plot is based on this misunderstanding.
Which is so easy to prove!
Yeah,
most romantic plots, to be fair, kind of are.
Yeah, it's true. So basically their goal is to have a conversation with the Volturi and say, look, you're misunderstanding, don't kill this child, look, she's not a vampire, with the idea that
vampires
they
don't text.
No, she has blood.
She has blood running through her
body. Vampires don't text.
And
send a text, is what I'm saying.
I know, but, like, it didn't...
But they're coming for
whatever.
Them. They don't believe them. So they need to witness the child and see that she's got blood basically flowing through her veins. So then they're like, okay.
YouTube video, whatever. Just cut your kid.
So the idea, to come back to my synopsis that I'm doing a great job of, is that they... want people to witness that conversation in case the Volturi sort of see that and then, like, don't listen anyways. Like, they'd be more likely to behave justly and sort of respond and say, oh, it's a misunderstanding, and then go home if there are all these witnesses who also know that she's a human, half vampire. Okay, so what happens?
They get onto the... I want to do it.
Okay. It's so hard.
No, I just want to... They get onto the battlefield. And go on, Sky.
So they get onto the battlefield. Thank you, Karen.
I just wanted to.
I know.
Can I do it? Yes.
So they get onto the
battlefield.
And they look like they're about to battle. And I say to Sky.
And I don't know.
Damn it, it's so important to me. But I was like, I hope that they just don't fight and they come to an agreement and then it's just over.
It's over. So, yeah.
Like,
Karen,
how feminist
that.
Would that be
yeah.
if they just
so
negotiated?
Right.
And go on.
And so we're hoping that they're going to negotiate. And what actually happens is Alice, who's a psychic.
No, you're jumping ahead. There's this huge battle.
No,
like,
but I'm not jumping ahead.
You're jumping ahead.
Because she walks on before the battle happens.
No,
she walks on before the battle happens and says, like, you know, look, she's a human. And then she says to the guy, the Volturi guy, like, oh, you don't care anyway. You're just going to fight. And then she turns around and yells, now! And this huge battle
This
erupts.
Huge battle happens.
So big. It's
and it's spectacle. And it's actually really, it's so, such a spectacle, but unlike the other ones, it doesn't operate on such, like, a feminine aesthetic or whatever.
It's so
super
violent.
Violent. You see, you, like, actually see people getting their vampire heads
big,
popped
and
off.
A lot of the main,
like,
characters have their heads popped off.
Yeah,
I
a lot
that,
of guys
actually.
Die, and, you know, Bella fights, and she acts as a shield, and whatever. But, like...
A lot of people die. It's a huge...
It's
lots
a
of death.
Lot
and, like,
of
main
die.
Characters in the Cullen family die.
Yeah, the Cullen dad dies.
It's really intense. Big cinematic music.
But I do want to stress how violent it is. Like, even though, like, we watch a lot of violent movies, and, like, I'm big into fantasy and all of that stuff, but it is quite violent.
All right.
Particularly,
can we get to the twist?
No. Because I want to talk about the spectacle of violence.
Well, I think it's particularly surprising relative to the sort of spectacle of male bodies and so on that's occurred through the rest of it, which
that's a really good point.
And this still is, I suppose, to a degree, not that I've seen it, I assume a little bit still a spectacle of male bodies. Because, like, 300 was violent, but it was still...
Yeah, I mean, what's his... Jacob takes off his shirt once.
Shocker. How do you look?
16? Fine, yeah. I feel like really young, and I'm not going to comment on it further.
Yeah.
So, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
That it did kind of seem less like it was going in from the realm... the spectacle, because Bill Condon, who's the director, is also, like, big into horror films, and I think that's why so much of the past, he just directed the two Breaking Johns, and that's why, like, there's been so much visceralness
because
of, like,
his...
spectacle and excess because of the operations of horror.
I actually love the idea of a horror director addressing
very,
like,
interesting
teen sexual fantasies. That's really interesting.
I'm
and
having
they all play
a hard
below
time
the surface.
No, but I think you're onto something about the masculine spectacle and violence.
Yeah, and I think there's a thing. Well, I like the idea of, like, what we experience viscerally, and how, like, good horror is felt before it's seen, and maybe that's true also of like romance and bodies. I don't know.
Yeah. But
Of teen sexuality more generally, like the idea of feeling that isn't put to words.
Yeah, I definitely think we're onto something here.
Yeah,
and I don't know how to articulate it further other than I had a very visceral experience during the. It was very the violence was very shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sky, go.
Okay.
Now.
So no, I do actually think that is something, but I just want to say, and then I think that sort of, like, it's like you create a fantasy, a moment, and that it is ruptured when there's a dialogue in a way. It becomes a lot more real and grounded, and so when you're just kind of creating a feeling first, that's more emotion, not content, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... Well, I think, you know, with movies and narratives like Twilight, that's really the domain in which they operate. Their feelings are not content, right?
But like, I don't think that their feelings, and I don't think that we should hierarchize content over feelings.
I
think feelings are far more important than content.
I think by over, she means that there are feelings in this rather than content, not as though...
But I don't think that there are. I mean, like, maybe it's just
maybe
because we're
trying.
Not...
But
it's
they're
us.
Designed to elicit emotion, you know? They're not
But
about
are they? Are there
thoughts.
Really sad moments? Like, it's not quite a weepy. Like, it's not quite, you know, a horror film. It's not quite any of these things.
Mm.
So what... I think it's maybe just desire of, like, what
certainly
it
desire.
Is. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of how, like, the ideal audience would be looking at this film, and I'm just wondering if there is...
I mean, I don't think that they would be, because the ideal audience is younger, and I think probably less responsive to violence because of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they wouldn't look at it and be like, that was really violent and scary. They were like, that was so much fun, and, like, that was, however, people really moving, and I love their world, and I want to be a part of it. So it's more like... less of emotion and more of a selling an ideal that's driving it.
Yeah.
Like, don't you want to be a part of this world?
And I think a big part of Twilight is the idea of immersion and the idea of identification.
Yeah.
And so this idea of viscerality would be enormous for that ideal crowd. I also want to, everything I know about Twilight, I know from the TV Tropes page. And also from a few years ago, I read this, I don't remember her name, this amazing blogger, did these, like, really, really funny summaries of them on her blog, and so I might be wrong here, so I'm just telling you that what I remember about the books is actually something I remember from years ago reading on a humor blog, but I think that the battle in the book happened exclusively off-screen. I don't think we got details of the battle in the book.
Well, I think this is a good segue to the big twist, Kate, actually.
I wish it wasn't. I mean, I wish she didn't. Anyway, come on.
So, in the battle... the idea is that after a long battle and a lot of deaths, sort of the Cullen's side
Michael
of things
Sheen
starts.
Dies.
Really?
He is one of the people that died.
Yes.
Oh, wait, I have a side story. Wait.
No.
No.
Not now.
Let me do this. Michael Sheen is like the head Volturi, right? So in the way the battle ends is sort of he dies and they rip off
okay,
his head.
Yeah, but Bella jumps on his back and grabs his head and like pops his head off.
Yeah, but then
she's just Bella.
Cut scene. And guess what?
That was a fantasy battle.
Didn't happen.
Fantasy battle.
Oh, in the future. From what's her face showing the future.
Vision was showing. She was showing Martin Sheen what would happen if they didn't talk it out. And then they talk it out. There's so
and then they leave. And then they leave. Totally accepted. Everything is fine.
That's the end of the movie.
Zero things happen
amazing.
In the movie.
Amazing. Because, A, imagine the audience reacting relative to the book. Like, imagine if we had, like, read, I was going to say Game of Thrones, and there was a battle scene that was, like, fuck, of course there is. But, like, imagine you're reading something, and the end is, like, a dispute that is settled happily, and then the movie, like, no
everybody
giant battle.
Dies. Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, all of the Twihards would have been like, like, are they doing this?
I
like,
wonder,
is this for real?
Yeah.
Whereas, like,
yeah.
I was like, oh my god, this happens?
I wonder if Bill Condon was like, yeah.
I really want to stress how long the battle was.
But
that's what's amazing. It was long and it was intense.
I felt so much emotion.
I did too. I think both Sky and I just started shaking and like making noises. Like we had no way of how to process it.
Well, the idea. That's amazing because that's exactly Glinda dancing, like the idea of you're shoehorning in a thing that's like stopping the plot.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah,
and it's spectacle that's stopping the plot.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's kind of the opposite of a woman performing a sensual dance.
It's masculinity is spectacle.
Yeah.
My side story is one time I failed to sell Michael Sheen a shirt. I just always want to, like, shoe in a celebrity encounter. I think that's my thing now that I'm going to do in every episode.
Yeah, and just, you know, remind people that you work in retail.
That I work in retail. And during TIFF, Michael Sheen came in and was like, hello, I hurt my shoulder. I live in LA. Do you have any short sleeve shirts? And I was like, no. Actually, my boss did. I just stood in the corner and was like,
hello. So you didn't do anything.
No, I just stood there and was like,
hello. Oh, great story.
Yeah.
So that was super crazy.
That's kind of amazing.
I think that someone could write a really good paper about male spectacle and all the Twilight movies.
I think that we should compare it, again, to 300, to Snyder, to just the idea of the, like, the excessive battle has always been a thing, but it's sort of being as celebrated as it is feels recent to me.
The thing about excess and spectacle that really get at me are, like, the spectacle of Twilight, of marriage, and, like, all of these so-called superficial things is really looked down upon. Yeah, the spectacle of, like, action movies and violence is, like, and not considered a spectacle at all. And I just hate that. Mm. I hate that people think that 25-minute-long action sequences are really adding to the plot.
I know, it's so boring.
And, like, it's okay because they exist in a masculine realm, and, like, therefore they're still seen as important.
That's
and
fabulous.
Potentially we could read Twilight in this realm as sort of making a very smart commentary by being like, look how long this is, and masculine and action-y, and look at how little it adds to this plot. It doesn't even matter because it's not even real. It's not even a real thing that moves the plot forward. As a matter of fact, it's just a fantasy, which is actually, like, a great statement about action films.
I know it is, and I keep having this problem of every time we've ever talked about Twilight,
make it sound better,
it's like there's
it
something, but what is it? We always talk ourselves into this hole of, like, there are lots of feminist things about Twilight.
Well, I mean, I have
in terms of, like, interesting deconstructions.
Yeah.
Of they're interesting deconstructions. I won't say that they're feminist. And, like, why
are they accidents, though?
Yeah.
Does it matter?
They don't
accidents
need
to. Does it? Yeah, yeah, they don't have to be. And, I mean, if we're going to talk about accidents, I think a lot of it is not accidental in terms of at least the past two movies, in terms of the screenwriter saying that she is pro-abortion and would never write anything that is anti-choice. Or at least, like, have it clearly be anti-choice in Bill Condon coming on as a director.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it always gets to me, because there's always these arguments of, I'm like, there's a way that Twilight is deconstructing these normal discourses, normal things in movies, and yet it's still, I still hate it. And how much of that is because I don't want to, I don't value, again, in quotes, feminine realm of thing. How much is it because, like, the patriarchy has, I've, like, internalized it to dislike these things and to find them unimportant?
That's a beautiful question, Kara.
I don't want to know the answer.
No, no,
but I'm bad both ways.
I wonder the degree to which, I mean, it's interesting because I think that fundamentally, and again, not having read them, but I think that the books seem poorly written and poorly structured, but there's an impulse to have, to do a very, an adaptation with a lot of fidelity. When you're adapting material that's as beloved as something like Twilight, or as something as widely read, and also with such a vocal fandom, and such an influential fandom. And so I wonder the degree to which something that is, like, structured atypically, in that it is structured badly, being adapted directly rather than restructured, as would happen generally with an adaptation. Like, I wonder how much of this is just symptomatic of something being unedited.
I mean, I don't know. It is edited, obviously, and one of the big things is, like, that huge battle sequence. And but I think something important to know is, like, Twilight didn't get that popular until the movies came out. Like, Twilight, movies, in terms of pop culture and not in terms of book sales, like, in terms of mainstream understanding of what Twilight is and getting people, it was the movies that really brought it.
Yeah, but the books were hugely read.
Yeah, they were, obviously, lots of people read them. But, I mean, in
terms
of being
enormously read.
I know, but in terms of being a cultural phenomenon, it sparked with the movies.
Well, I think the cultural phenomenon of, like, a negative response to Twilight and dislike of Twilight.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Certainly.
The movies grossed bajillions of dollars
without
the first movie knowing that it was going to be like that. Mm-hmm. It was, like, a smaller, not independent film, but, you know, it kind of was a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of nowhere, because I think a lot of people disregarded that young audience, even though, like, come on, Harry Potter did really well. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's something important to keep in mind, is, like, the movies and the books. I think that there's some...
But I think by the end there, like, certainly by the third adaptation, like, the third... that, like, it was already a phenomenon.
Yeah, it was already a phenomenon, I'm saying, but, like, that the movies have some power outside of just adaptations of the books.
Yeah, sure.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think I was just sort of reflecting on all the things we've said, and it is, I guess I feel very confused about, and I agree with you, Kara, I feel confused because I feel like you're right in the sense that everything we say about Twilight makes it sound so interesting, and so, like, making explicit the constructed nature of these kinds of fictions, and, like, making visible that there's an author that is, like, pulling strings behind a curtain, and that that's making choices, and that characters are passive and are empty, and, like, these long spectacles are fundamentally empty. And I guess I wonder, like, where, I think that there's something there, but I'm wondering, like, where does that happen? Is it in the narratives? If we read the books, will we feel the same way? Is it in the narrative choices? Or is it in, like, the way those films are specifically constructed and the way spectacles used in the films?
I think for me, you know, being a filmmaker and into film, it is specifically film. I think if I were to read the books, I don't think I would get very far because I'd be like, these are written so shittily.
They're so boring.
And super boring because, like, if they're not written well and they don't have a good plot, it's like, what is this book for?
Yeah, and you're not getting, like, spectacle doesn't exist in the novel.
Yeah, and I don't think spectacle, I mean, I don't think that you really meant this, but spectacle in excess isn't meaningless. It's not empty.
Mm.
There's a lot of use for it.
Oh, certainly.
And is that it dismissed as empty and meaningless?
I have an inkling that is the idea that, like, the structures and the wires and the chords are visible in this movie would be really interesting if it wasn't just because the movie was poorly made. And it feels to me like most movies, the point is to hide your wires, and this one fails to... Like, the movie isn't trying to be a movie that is showing you the wires.
No, but it isn't showing you the wires. I mean, I don't know what you mean by that.
It seems a little bit like you're saying that, like, these structures that are exposed and the failures of these systems. And it's in the way that, like, people watch B-movies and bad films in order... Like, people who appreciate paracinema and bad movies need to have a pretty strong understanding of how a movie's made in order to identify the failures of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn just as much about movie making from a shittily made film as you do from a well-made film. And I just feel like this seems to have more trappings of analyzing a bad film and what that tells us rather than analyzing a good film and what that tells us. Bad here being used as, like, poorly made as in.
Yeah, and it's obviously different because it's not poorly made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, it has an enormous budget.
I mean, there's...
And obviously, like, the camera's not shaking.
The differences of making a poorly made B-horror movie and this are super different.
Like, obviously, but
I do think
shaking.
That you're onto something.
Yeah.
In that it isn't... But it's not just failing at being a good movie. I think that there is something that
there's
is
an
outside of
it.
There's
it's
an
not
active,
just like a...
Yeah, there's an active not being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the difference.
Yeah, yeah. It's not just like an absence
of
good. There's like... There's
well, by
like,
good here, I don't mean like...
I know.
It's... What I guess I'm just saying is it's not like the film attempts and fails. It's like there's some weird layer on it.
I'm going to throw it out there. Good. Brechtian?
Well, just again, I want to say the first three movies are just poorly made. Like,
mm-hmm.
they're trying to be something and they're not good at it. At least in my memory of it. Maybe if I go back and rewatch them, but I watched them last year.
The first
so
one
can't be that different.
Hilarious. So, like, there's
yeah,
makeup
it's
lines.
Just, it's, yeah, it's poorly made. It's trying to be something. But the last two don't seem like they're trying to be something different than they are.
And they have a very distinct
tone. They have a distinct
tone. It's consistent, and it's consistently fucking weird.
Yeah, it's, like, yeah. And it seems no one making that score would be like,
this makes sense,
unless they're going for something else.
Do you think Bill Condon or the other people who are maybe, like, higher up in the structure of, like, getting this film made the way it was made, are kind of fucking with us? Like, do you think they got all this money?
Totally. I mean,
yeah.
Gus Van Sant was going to direct one of them. Like, there's no way...
Amazing.
I know, there's no way that they're taking it 100%. They're being
even
a little
subversive.
Even
the screenwriter said that she's, you know, when she said she's pro-life, said she wouldn't have taken it on if she didn't think there was a way of making it pro-life.
And
yeah.
we know Edward... We know Edward hates the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some...
Rob,
there's some weird dismantling from inside.
Yeah,
from inside.
Totally.
Not to make it like
totally.
A big conspiracy.
No, that's interesting. Like, I think that there's, I mean, there's also the idea of, like, maybe the editor didn't have the material to make the film the studio was making because of whatever. Like, I mean, there's probably some dissonance just between the different, like, production phases of this
and
film.
And honestly,
but...
by the time they got to these past two ones, like, I don't know how involved the studio would be, but they'd be like, it's going to make a bajillion dollars no matter how shitty it is.
Yeah.
Like, stick somewhat to the books and have the same cast, and it's like, all right, they're going to make a bajillion dollars.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I think that kind of leaves a little bit of freedom, weirdly, but it also might not. Maybe they did have a big role in it. I'm just, I don't know.
That's interesting. It sounds like there's sort of some erosion from within.
We salute you, Twilight. And we salute
like
the resistance. We salute the resistance from within, Twilight. Whoever you are, man behind the curtain or woman.
The best boy.
Yeah, I think it was the best boy that changed her name.
It's always the best boy. Was Michael Sheen really good? I hear he's really good in that.
No.
Really?
I mean,
he's a lot of fun to watch. Everyone in
like
two of his articles I've read.
It's really creepy.
It's just campy.
Like camp.
Yeah. I mean, and, like, it's weird because the film isn't that campy, and yet, you know, he comes on being campy.
This feels, okay, do you guys remember American Horror Story?
Everybody on it is
I
mocking the film
it.
In their own way.
Yeah.
Their own private way.
That actually,
except for, I think, Jacob.
Ernest.
He's
poor Jacob.
Very seriously.
The point I wanted to make, though, about American Horror Story is it's a really, really strange show tonally. Because it feels like I can never tell when something is so ridiculous it's supposed to be funny or just supposed to be, like, intense. And the actors all seem to be acting for different shows than each other and every episode. And it feels like, and I don't think it's a good show, but I think it's a very interesting show to watch. Because sometimes it does things that are unlike anything I've seen.
Someone told me recently that it's actually really scary.
It's not. It's dumb. This season, I haven't seen this season. Okay. I just saw season one. But like,
I mean, I'm not going to watch it.
It's. But I wonder, because you haven't seen it, and I haven't seen Twilight, but I just, the way you're describing how watching it feels to me a lot like what I consider to be a, like, huge failure, but a fascinating one of American Horror Story.
Right.
Yeah.
Where I never... understood what I was supposed to be feeling or why anyone did anything ever.
And doesn't it make us, I mean, it's interesting how it makes us feel so lost when someone, a movie maker, is not like, here is how you should be feeling
exactly.
at this moment. And like how we think that that's a bad thing when really it's like, just decide how you're feeling.
And I take it even further. It's like not just lost, but like potentially even betrayed. Like,
yeah, totally.
Like, angry and, like, violated.
Yeah, and, like, make us call it a bad movie.
To push onto us.
But, like, a happy scene not having a happy score, like, that actually just kind of fundamentally highlights the way in which film always manipulates us. Like, a moment is
and
happy.
And how we're so used to it that we desire it, that we call movies that don't do it, like, really shitty.
Talk about not being active.
Yeah.
Audience.
Yeah.
Us. You too. I haven't
think your
even
own
seen
thoughts.
It.
Yeah. Oh my god, so do our own thoughts mean we like Twilight?
What about
like
you guys?
American Story?
What do you think, audience? Did you guys secretly like Twilight?
But it's not even secretly like, because
I'm trying
like,
to wind this up.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, there's no something in me that secretly likes it. Like, it's just I'm unclear about how I feel about it. I'm unclear that if I dislike it, it's because
the reasons you
it's
feel
not like
the
I'm,
feelings
I'm
you feel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I that's actually whenever I was trying to talk about American Horror Story, I found it really hard to approach critically because I couldn't quantify anything aside from quantify that I was unquantifiable.
Yeah. All right, wrap it up.
So what did you guys think, audience? Did you secretly like Twilight just like Kara did?
No! This is exactly what I did not say.
Just like she just said she did? Do you think, are you Team Edward or Team Jacob?
Is
that
still
need to talk
her imprinting, but...
Oh, no, and that's like our big
that
thing.
That was creepy!
I guess that's it. It was creepy. How, anyway.
Sex with
I think
child.
We all know.
I think that's not a new or controversial statement.
That's okay. Go on.
But
they're coming
like
down
the,
on
the
not
grooming,
on the side of child rape.
The grooming of a child to be your lover as they grow up.
Yeah.
That's very creepy.
I feel like there's probably... No, I don't know. Okay.
There's nothing subversive about Twilight.
Well, it wasn't
going to
be subversive.
No, no, I mean, if Twilight doing that.
Oh, no. Lord, no. What
maybe.
Else can we say? What, do you have a child? Is it a feminist child? Are you a feminist who raised a feminist child?
Are you
let
a second wave feminist? Does your child hate you now?
Yeah. Are they post-feminist now?
Are they Team Jacob? Are they Team Renesmee and Jacob? Sound off in the comments. Visit us online at www.bunk.com.
Oh my god, we didn't even... I need to tell you something.
Oh my god, go.
Bunk from The Wire is in it.
Bunk's there?
Yeah.
Why? Is he a vampire?
For no reason. He's dealing with the vampires to, like, give them
he's a mediator.
To give them passports. And he's in one scene, and I'm like, what?
Oh shit.
He's passports, like, and they use the passports in the dream part, and that's it.
But they don't even use them. They run off, and then it's... They don't even...
Oh my
it's
god.
So... Hilarious.
Yo, guys, Bunk made it.
Bunk made it.
The Bunk made it.
Yeah. I mean, and all the other The Wire actors, as we know, are working on The Good Wife.
Every one of them is on The Good Wife.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Only the black ones.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any Wire actors.
I don't even
anything.
Remember.
Anyway, visit us online at a website of onezone.com. Until next
follow
week.
Follow us on Twitter, please.
At Tweets of One Zone. And until next week, I don't know, happy hunting. What do they say in Twilight?
Forever.
I do.
Do they have a catchphrase?
Forever is just the beginning. That must be it. That has to actually be it. Did I just make that up?
I don't know.
That must be it. I can't have made that up. It's stupid.
It's like the lamb and the...
They say, don't imprint on my infant daughter.
No, it's like... And
the lion...
So the lion...
Lay down with the lamb. That was in the book, yeah. I saw some gross